You know, this particular meeting this morning, this now starting afternoon, has been something just like all AA conferences. I've met a lot of new people. I've met a lot of people that I've known and hadn't seen in a long time. And that's what AA, that's what the conferences are all about, is getting us together. You know, the book talks about nothing ensures, well, and I'm, you know, paraphrasing, nothing ensures us from drinking like constant contact with a newcomer, and then it gives you that AA zinger, and with each other. And that's what these conferences are doing, and I want to thank Bill for inviting me up, the committee, and it's just been a great conference. And it's interesting because the first talk I ever made was in a Lutheran church. And this is the only talk I've made since then in a Lutheran church. And I went outside to see if the buzzards were flying. When I play golf now, they can spot me on the course because, well, so hopefully this won't be my last conference. And it's just been great. The speakers have been great. I don't know that I've ever heard two better speakers that were more capable. And I think sometimes it's God-inspired at how they were able to get the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, the power that Alcoholics Anonymous puts in our lives and transforms us from what we were to what we are now. I think our two speakers in front of me did a great job at doing that. It's just fabulous to see the miraculous things that happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think I'm here this morning because I'm really an alcoholic that found a substitute for alcohol. And that's what I needed. I didn't know that's what I was looking for. For the last 5 years of my drinking, I was looking for that, to substitute for alcohol. I knew I couldn't handle alcohol, but I didn't particularly care about AA. Y'all were a little bit below, so I did a lot of searching. And when I finally got here, I had passed the way I see it, the book described it, I'd passed all human aid because I had tried everything human that I knew to get my life squared away. So when they got here and they told me about this substitute for alcohol, they said that I had to do some things if it was going to work. I had to get a home group. I had to go to meetings. I had to get in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to treat it as a textbook, not just something you read and put down. Refer to it on a different basis. I had to learn the 12 steps, take those principles and put them to work in my life, and constantly be in touch with other alcoholics and with my sponsor. And because I did those things to the very best of my ability, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September the 25th, 1973. Now, for that, I'm very grateful. But I want to also tell you that since that day in September of 73, I haven't found it necessary to be analyzed, tranquilized, hypnotized, or baptized. Alcoholics Anonymous has done it all for me. And it just happened that way. I've been very fortunate. And, you know, you hear an awful lot about problems other than alcohol. We even got a pamphlet on problems other than alcohol. Well, man, I had problems other than alcohol before I ever knew alcohol existed. See, I'm not only an alcoholic, I'm a hillbilly. And I'm from the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia. You heard Dave this morning talking about his drunk people that came, drunk ancestors who came from the western part of Virginia out near Wythville. Well, I was born and raised 15 miles from Wythville at a place called Jackson's Ferry. Now, don't everybody stand up and ever heard of Jackson's Ferry, but my mother was a hillbilly school teacher, and I'm her only son. And they named me Sterling Fletcher Watts III. I don't think I had a chance from the very start. And things took over. I never realized this till I got sober and looked at my life. But one of my problems right from the very start that bothered me was not having any identity. Mama taught school for 40 years, so the first 18 years of my life, wherever I went, I was known as Miss Kitty's little boy. And at 18, I went across the river and I married a prominent farmer's daughter. Overnight, I became Mac Jackson's son-in-law. I got away from the mountains and came down to South Carolina, and I had one son who was quite a football player, All-State, played at Clemson and later signed in the pros, and overnight I became Waldo's daddy. And so, you know, you can see that when you all, I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'd allow me to stand up here and say I'm Sterling Fletcher Watts, that meant a lot. I mean, I felt like I'd arrived, you know, and I'm not sure how all of you all got here. I hear about a lot of people that knock on the door and say I drank a little bit too much and I'm, you know, I wrecked a car and things aren't going too well. My mouth stuck together this morning and I want to come in and be in AA and work the principles and get spiritual. I didn't do it that way. I had all the help in the world. I had help, but I didn't want to have help from. I had help from judges and lawyers and mainly from nosy neighbors. And I had a lot of help from Al-Anon. My wife got in Al-Anon about 6 or 8 months before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I say that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I became powerless over Al-Anon. And And I don't know, do any of you ever remember the first time that they asked you to read? Finally, you'd been sober long enough that one of these white-haired or no-haired old men came up and asked you to read something, and I felt so good about it. In fact, I went back in the restroom and practiced. I didn't want to miss one word. I wanted to put emphasis where emphasis was supposed to be, the whole deal. And the chairman that night forgot my name, and he says to read how it works is Nancy's husband. And I thought, and that just pulled the rug right out from under me. And you know, with an ego like I have, I needed that then, and I need it now. I go places, and I begin to think I know something, and I'm going to share all this knowledge, and there'll be some old-timer sitting there like Bill or some of them, and they'll say, call on old what's-his-name. And I need that. I need that kind of thing. I was also a liar, and I was a good liar. I know that everybody in AA usually tells a lie now and then, but I was a real good liar, and I was a different kind of a liar. I didn't lie and leave. I hung around and kept pecking at you till I was sure you believed that lie I told you, you know. And I'd lie about anything. For instance, when we were about this big, incidentally, I was raised in a fundamentalist home. I don't know whether that's got anything to do with why I'm an alcoholic or not, but it's part of my story. But anyhow, when I was about so big, we had to memorize verses to repeat before we ate on Sunday. And I remember memorizing Bible verses, quite capable of it. But I loved to make them up. And one of the verses I made up was, if a man goeth a long journey and returneth not, he stayeth a long while. And what I liked about that was the old folks thumbing through their Bibles. Now, that right there, that got me. That got me, just made me feel warm all over when that happened. And I was raised in this home. There were four of us in the home. There was a mother, a father, and I had a sister 5 years older than I, and me. And all of them had an idea of what they wanted me to do. Daddy wanted me to be a lawyer. Mama wanted me to be a Methodist preacher. My sister just wanted me to go away. Everybody had something. Nobody asked me what I wanted. Nobody asked me what I wanted. And I look back on this now, what my first desires were about looking into the future of what I'd like to be. And we had an old boy there named R.L., and his daddy was a drunk, and he lived with his daddy, and his mom had left him, but left the drunk, but as women do, and so he's being raised by a drunk daddy, and he had no rules to follow. He could go barefoot anytime he wanted to. He could swim naked anytime he wanted to. And most of all, he had no rules. He didn't even have to take a bath unless he wanted to. And I just thought this was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. I even liked R.L. I liked the way R.L. smelled. He had that gusto, you know. And as I perceived this thing, everywhere I went, I smelt like Lifebuoy soap. Mama was always washing on me to see if my ears were clean. So my first prayer, as I remember it, was that Daddy'd get drunk, Mama'd leave home, and I could live there with my daddy and be like R.L. Now, you know, some things never change, really. Sometimes now when I get on a couple of weeks off and we go on a vacation, I don't shave and maybe not shower for a day or two. And Judy will look at me and say, I believe R.L.'s coming to visit, you know. So, but you never know. Now, drinking was not a problem to me, really. I got to tell you about Elizabeth, my sister, though, before I go any further. She was the only perfect person that ever walked the face of this earth. She never told a lie. She was straight-A student all through school, dean's list in college. That girl was just perfect. And don't you kid yourself, they never let me know. They would say, why can't you be like Elizabeth? I had no idea why I couldn't be like Elizabeth. I ain't so sure I wanted to be like Elizabeth, but that's how I approach life. I knew that I didn't even muster up to my sister, who was raised by the same parents and the same surroundings and everything, and I was much less. And so I approached life being much less, and I didn't know exactly why. Drinking was not a big problem to me as a teenager because I was so closely supervised. But shortly after graduating from high school in 1946, I joined the service, and I had to go 55 miles away from the mountains down to Roanoke to be inducted in the service. And that's the first time I'd ever been that far away from home without adult supervision. And that was in September of 46. And that night I got drunk and I got sick and I almost died. And I loved it today when our two speakers talked about, and I won't bore you with it, I got sick drunk stories, but you all have heard, you all know that alcoholics do get sick and they do puke. I was a good puker, I still am a good puker today. I'm the best in the family. When you get the flu or something, they watch me. He knows how to do it. But anyway, I got, you use whatever you learn, you know. But anyway, I 26 years later, three states away, I'm still drinking too much, I'm still getting sick, and I'm still almost dying. So I have no problem of realizing what the insanity of my disease is. And that's because for 27 years, going through all this puking and a lot of other things, I never once considered that liquor was a problem. Never once considered it. And to me, that had to be insane. Being in service, that's another story. Right quick, they had a window of 18 months. You could go and get in, get out, get your GI Bill, go to college, do everything that World War II veterans did. And that's what I did. I went in for 18 months. I stayed drunk for 13 and basically and in trouble the whole time. And I spent most of that 13 months in Korea doing nothing, and when I got back to Stoneman, I was out there about 2 weeks, and the captain called me in, and he said, watch, you a fine young man. He said, if you will take an honorable discharge and leave this post Friday, I'll sign that discharge. But if you stay here one more week, more than likely you're going to end up in Leavenworth. And so that's how I got out with an honorable discharge. And it's interesting, I think our book talks about it some, you know, there's possibly that an alcoholic can, for a certain length of time, when things are going right, he can arrest his disease. I drank as alcoholically as I ever drank in my life that when I was 17 and 18 years old in the Army. Now, I slept on pool tables. I slept in doors. The MPs are picking me up, trying to find out where to take me. Now, the thing that's interesting, I hated the Army. I hated every minute of it from the day I got there, from when I put my hand down from being sworn in and they started telling me what to do. I hated it. Anyway, when I got home, things got well. Industry moved into the mountains, and I got a job immediately with a textile mill. I didn't follow through on that college education because obviously I met my childhood sweetheart, and romance and studying doesn't go along too well together. Anyway, I met my childhood sweetheart, and we got married, and I'm doing well in the textile mill. A year later, my son came along, and 1955, a group of husbands bought a little piece of land, and we all built these built homes like in the woods, like everybody was doing after World War II, and things were just they were going along well. I worked real hard, worked whatever they wanted me to do, any amount of overtime. I realize now if you're going to drink like I drink, you had to work long to have money to drink, but I got a lot of promotions, and so things are going along fine. And if you'd really looked at me from a period of like 1948, when I got home, to 1962, which I had to do, if I looked at my life, I never suspected a thing. Everything just looked rosy and beautiful. But yet, when I inventory that, I was in five or six during that time, five or six automobiles that was totally lost. Sometimes I was driving, sometimes I was riding. Most generally, we had no idea who was driving and who was riding. And during that time on a Thanksgiving day, I had three accidents the same day. And that day, I hit the same man twice. Now, you know, in those days, all you had to do was call your insurance man and report it, and they'd fix your car. And I remember reporting that second accident. Now, I didn't hit him, like, right here in the parking lot twice. I got him 15 miles over in the afternoon before I'd hit him that morning. And I remember reporting that accident. And the insurance man said to me, he said, "Watts, how drunk are you?" I said, "Why?" He said, "You reported that accident this morning." I said, "Man, I'm not drunk. I've hit him again, you know." Man, give me a break, you know. Well, now, while I'm taking this inventory during all this, I realize that I've been a victim. I've been a victim all my life. As I perceive it, and I can only tell you how I perceive things, if I moved into your community tomorrow, I'd be right in the middle of a whole bunch of handymen and good gardeners. And I'm neither one. I don't know a screwdriver from a pliers. I don't have a good yard because I couldn't care less. I like a pretty yard, but not if I have to do it. And so right away when we got married, it started, "Why can't you be like Tom? And why can't you be like Bill?" And I said, "Well, you know, that didn't bother me. I went to boot camp on why you couldn't be like Elizabeth. So I'm just settled right into this, you know." Well, when we built these houses, these husbands built these houses, we intended for them to be turnkey jobs. But the handymen didn't allow that to happen. They started taking shortcuts. Some of them put in decks. Some of them put the roof on. Some of them put in the furnace. They're all doing something. And I think that's the first time I ever remember an impending doom that they talk about in the book. She's looking at me about, "Big boy, when are you going to do something?" And And, you know, I used to drink real intelligent liquor, and it would make me just come alive, and I could notice things, be very, just things that nobody else would ever notice. I noticed one day that nobody on that street yet had put their mailbox in. Now, by this time in my career of drinking, I was using liquor to do anything. Anytime I had a task that I didn't like, I had mentally assigned a certain amount of liquor to it. If I was going to mow the yard, it took a pint or it took a case of beer, according to how hot it was. I didn't like to trade cars. I knew I was going to get skinned. That took a fifth. If I was going to borrow money, I didn't like the banker. That took a fifth. I didn't get along with Elizabeth, my sister. I called her my two-pint sister if she's coming to visit, you know. Well, I never had to put a mailbox in. But it's hot and it's in July, and I know I don't want to do it, so I'm sure that I assigned a good amount of liquor to this task of putting the mailbox in. And it's a little bit evident here that I did. It looks like from the very start, this started out to be kind of an alcoholic deal of doing this mailbox. I went down to the plant and I got the head engineer. I didn't get the welder. I got the head engineer, and I had him took a 2-foot pipe, an 8-foot pipe, 2-inch in diameter, and put another 1.5-inch pipe down in that, and we spot welded it all the way up. And I came back home. And I put it down in 4 feet of steel reinforced concrete. And I went down to Sears and bought the biggest mailbox they had. And I put Sterling Fletcher Watts III across, just let it flow. Probably in old English letters, I don't remember. But I tamped that real well. And you know, only you drunks will know. When you've drank all day and you've done a deed that you think is great, you just drop off into that slumber. And I remember going, just, boy, she's going to be proud of me when she gets back from her daddy's tomorrow. Done a good job. And I slipped off into sleep, and the next morning my phone rang 5:00. It's my neighbor. He said, "Watch, what was wrong with you yesterday?" I said, "Why?" He said, "You got that mailbox in facing your house." Now, and I had an hour or so to get it dug up and turned around. It looked like I'd built a small swimming pool and filled it in, you know. And so, you know, by now in my life, everything is that I liked seemed like it had something to do with drinking. And my wife hated the whole drinking scene. I never have done in my life anything that really pleased the ladies. Some of you guys will understand. You'll understand laying out on the creek bank drunk with an old fishing pole out there in the line looking at it, or playing cards all night and that kind of thing. I loved it. Well, she didn't like any of that. And from time to time, you know, I'd quit drinking. And I'm going to quit forever because you're fussing. And she'd say, she could almost tell. I've had her say, "You almost stopped and got a beer." She knew when I was thinking about it. And this got so bad, she hated everything that I liked. And we had developed at this stage of the thing, it was kind of like a muscular reaction to chemicals. When I bent a muscle and to take a chemical, her mouth flew open. And we automatically, and I call that chin music. And that was the chinniest woman that you ever saw in your life. I never got to drink at peace. There just wasn't any such thing as that. And by this time I'd worked myself up. I'm purchasing a lot of equipment and chemicals for the plant. A lot of salesmen are calling on me. And they come into town and they bring a lot of liquor for them. And we have happy hour and they drink just like I do. And I get to watching these guys. I'm sharp as they are. I drink like they drink, but they got one thing I don't have. They leave home on Monday, and they don't go back home till Friday. No more chin music for 5 days. So I gave up probably the very best job I ever had with Burlington Industries and went to South Carolina to sell chemicals. And I know today I went to South Carolina to drink. And I went to work for a one-owner company. And he was home based in Ashton, Rhode Island. And he told me an interesting thing. You know, a nice old man. He said, I want you to take this new car. He brought me the keys and an unlimited expense account. And my name's not known. The company name's not known in the South. And I want you to take three states, South Carolina, Georgia, and some of Louisiana, and see that my name gets well known. Well, you're getting ahead of me, but you're right. You're right. You're right. No question about that. I know today that he meant where he had chemicals to sell, but I got them everywhere. During this sprint of time, I don't know how many years it was, you can work hard no matter what you're doing, and they won't let you. They just won't leave you alone. They stop and ask for your driver's license. They're nosy, and I'm just trying to make a living. I'm paying taxes. I'm not a no-good drunk. I'm working every day. I'm on the way to the job, but they want to see your driver's license. And then the next thing, they want you to walk a line, and then it's breathalyzer. Because of this, as I went through it selling these chemicals, it's interesting what happened. In Virginia, and you all know more about this than I do now, I've forgotten, but we could only have so much liquor in the car at one time. It was either a quart per person or 5 quarts or something. We were limited at that time to how much liquor we could carry in the car. But in South Carolina, all you could pay tax, all you could buy. And I took that old Ford and I loaded the whole back end of that car up with booze. And I drive around. Most of the plants I called on were finishing plants, dying and finishing, and they were way out in the country. And that's because of the odor they had. But I'd drive into these little country towns up and I'd raise the trunk and they'd get off from work and we'd have a few drinks there in the parking lot or go around to the fishing hole or down to the golf course. And I had one guy down at Abbeville, South Carolina. He said, you know, Sterling, you called down here for 19 months and we wasn't sure what you selling. He said, we thought you was a liquor salesman in the wrong place. We didn't know. Later on, I told that story, and there was one of my old customers out there, and he came up after the thing. He said, it didn't matter what you sell it. The idea was you had the liquor. But anyway, so I'm driving, and I'm working hard, and I'm doing real well. I'm doing real well. And the state troopers are getting, they just get nosy. They won't let me do my job. In fact, now, I had 5 for sure DUIs and maybe 6 and never lost my driving record. Now, that shows you what kind of a con man I had become. Now, I do know this, that had I been held responsible for the very first DUI that I had, lost my driver, or paid any kind of consequences, then you'd have a different story, and I'd have a different life. But I felt just like God. When I'd beat one of those trips, I might get out of jail, and I'd go right by the Elks Club or the Bootleggers and get a half a pint, drink it and throw it out on the courthouse steps. They just can't stop me. And when it talks about roaring through people's life like a tornado, that's what I was doing. And that's what being able to buy out of these things, that it just made me unaccountable. And I really just thought that I was too clever for them. I was too smart for them. I've been in jail probably 5, 6, 7 times. Didn't always get in there when I got caught for DUI. But I'd get out of jail, and not once did I have to prevail on a member of my family to come and get me out of jail. I would leave there patting myself on the back that I had gotten out on by my own ingenuity, by some hook or crook, and I hadn't bothered my wife or my mother, my father, anybody. Now, the insanity of this disease is, why didn't I think not to get in jail? Why did I not look why I got in jail? The fact that I felt so smart for being able to get out of there on my own without bothering anybody kept me going back. I just never, none of this ever dawned on me. When you drink like this on a daily basis, a weekly basis, it begins to get your health and and you're doing crazy things. I think our speaker this morning talked about being called crazy. I was doing crazy things, and neighbors are getting upset, and a lot of people giving my wife things that ought to be done with me. So the first thing I decided that, you know, I'd been to the ministers and the psychologists and this, but I hadn't really been to a psychiatrist. So they decided I ought to go on this psychiatric route. And now I have every amount of respect for psychiatry. In fact, during my time, I've sponsored two psychiatrists. But this is my story. I'm of the opinion that if you're an alcoholic and you don't want to be there, you're not going to get a bit of help from a psychiatrist because you're not going to tell him the truth. In fact, I contend that there's no psychiatrist I ever met that's a match for an alcoholic that don't want to be there. I'd have had this guy in the institution if he had kept seeing me. I can tell you that. And I'd leave there laughing like hell at what I'd have him decide the craziest things you've ever seen, and I'd leave her and laugh at him, you know. Well, he was smart enough to realize this thing, and finally he said, I heard him tell my wife, says, I'm going the next time he acts up. Now that's what I like. He didn't say the next time he got drunk, but the next time he acts up, I got to put him where I can observe him more closely. And down in Greenville, at that time, this is in the late 60s, they didn't have a detox, they didn't have a treatment center. The only place they had was jail or a hospital for the emotionally disturbed. And jail didn't want you because they put everybody on the chain gang. I weighed almost 300 pounds and couldn't get out of the top bunk, so they didn't want me in jail. So I ended up going to our place in Greenville. We call it Marshall Pickens, but it's our for anybody that might know Greenville, and it's the place for the emotionally disturbed. Now, it's interesting. I've been over there 4 or 5 times. I've been over there in the back of a pickup truck. I've been over there in the trunk of a car. I've been over there in an ambulance. I've been over there any amount of transportation to get me there. Each time I went, I was dog drunk. And you look at my medical records, drunk's never mentioned. It's hypertension, schizophrenia, paranoia. I guess at the prices they were charging, they were embarrassed to put down drunk. You know, I don't know. But it's interesting. I'm a type of alcoholic that give me a couple of 3 shots of liquid Valium, and I'll just go to sleep, and I'll sleep maybe 2-3 days. If I wake up, you give me another shot, I'll go right back to sleep. So after about 5 days, I'll just pop 2, and I'm ready to go and get with it. And I remember that this time when I woke up, I'm in occupational therapy. And we're doing great things. We're making leather watch bands. We're making ceramic ashtrays. Now, I'm talking quality stuff here now. And I got real good. I wasn't too awfully good at the ceramic ashtrays. But I was excellent at those leather watch bands. And I got where I could make 3 leather watch bands in 1 hour. And the next best person in there, it took them 3 hours to make one. I'm popping those watch bands out. If they hadn't run out of leather, I'd still be over there. I can tell you that. I remember my wife came to see me, and she said, you know, your company's beginning to wonder where you are and what you're doing. And she said, you may get fired. Don't you worry about it. I can stay on down there as a head occupational therapist because I'm the best one in that class, you know. So that wasn't getting to me. Now, in this particular institution, they had about 20 of us to a group, called us clients. And if you'd been good all week, you got a reward on Saturday. Well, somebody asked me, if you're in the hospital, how can you be bad? Well, in this particular hospital, they've got a fountain out front. It's about 60 feet high, shoots the water. I put a box of Tide in there. They had a snowball big as this church. And now, they call that being bad, so we didn't get a reward that week. But this particular week, we'd all been good. And we were gathered, the way you did this thing, you gather up at front and up at the back and in the vestibule back there, or the whatever, and they'd tell you what your reward was. And our reward this day was to get a peanut butter sandwich and get to hike over to Kmart. And, of course, I'm thrilled. But anyway, the guy called me over and he said, look, said, most of these ladies are taking shock treatments, and they're nervous. And he said, they all smoke. And he said, we can't let them have matches. But here you keep the matches, and if they need a match, they'll come to you, and you help them light their cigarette. Well, I remember walking down the steps of that hospital, and I looked back at my little entourage, and I felt they finally found my leadership abilities. Somebody has discovered them. I felt like I'd been in officer's candidate school, you know. It never dawned on me that what really happened. It took a year and a half. I'm a year sober anyway, and I look back, and what had actually happened, I'm 44 years old, and I worked my way up to the keeper of the matches in a nut house. That's what it amounted to. But I remember when I finally got out of there, and I would do this. Each time I'd get out, I'd drink about a half a pint and go home and report my progress. And I did that this day, and I wasn't fooling her. She knew that I was drinking. She said, you know, you've never been rehabilitated. You need to, there's some people, some places that absolutely specialize in rehabilitating drunks. And that's what you need. Well, we didn't want to miss anything, I can tell you. So there was a place down in the lower part of South Carolina that was run by the state, that was a rehabilitation center, and off I went. Now, I got down there, and I never had as bad a resentment as I ever had in my life. Now, I didn't know what a resentment was, but I was mad. Everybody in there, we had about 30 in this particular class that I went in with, and they were all wards of the state. None of them had a job, so the state was paying for them to be there. We had a doctor, and he just locked his practice up 3 or 4 weeks ago. He's in there, and he's not paying anything. I still got a job, but I got no insurance. And it's going to cost me $600 to get what everybody else is getting for nothing, and I was mad. Now, I'll get back to that $600. I think God kindly used that later on to get my attention, make me start thinking. But anyway, they said, one of the things they said was, we don't sponsor Alcoholics Anonymous because we're a state place, but we do allow them, at their request, to come in on Thursday and have a meeting, and if you'd like to go, feel free. I had nowhere else to go, so I went. Now, what they did, and they still do this, they had groups come in from as far as 50 miles away, and they had somebody tell their story like I'm telling mine. And I'm sitting there, and this guy talking looks like he's about 25 at the most, maybe 30. And he said an interesting thing. He said he couldn't take one drink without getting drunk. Well, I never felt so sorry for anybody in my life. Can you imagine one drink drunk? And so I thought there's something wrong here, is all I can tell you. I thought y'all were really sick people. I wrote his name down, and I knew that when I got out of there, if I could locate him, if I could keep him buying, I could keep him going 3 or 4 weeks anyway. I mean, anyway. So that's what I really got out of that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Well, when I left down there, they told me an interesting thing. They said, go back to Greenville and don't drink. And we think you'll be all right. Well, I was thinking about this going back to Greenville, and I thought, I'm not so sure about that. I knew alcohol was my trouble if I'd handled it a different way, but I just wasn't so sure that they knew what they were talking about. And I got to thinking, you know, I'm going to do exactly what they told me. I'm going back and I'm not going to drink. I'm going to prove to them this don't work, and I'll sue them and get my $600 back. So I did go back to Greenville, and that's all I did. I just took alcohol out of my life. I put nothing else in. And nobody here has to try that. If you're new here now, don't try it, please. It's the most miserable time of my life. I took the alcohol out. I put no program, no God, no nothing in. just that alcohol gone and all those raw nerves in there. All of the things, all the defects are still there. Everything that caused me to drink from the start is still in there. I'm working on nothing, and I'm hating the world. I hate everybody I come in contact with. I hate you if you can drink and not get in trouble. I hate you if you can not drink and have fun. And I'm exploding with hate. Nobody wants to be around me. And I did get drunk, and I couldn't stand it anymore with that hate. And I did get drunk, and that started a period of time, I'm not sure how many months, of drinking. And I call it drinking zombolically. I was just a zombie. I absolutely didn't know what was going on. I'd leave the house, and it seemed like I'd come to when a hand hit the steering wheel. If I looked down and I'm dressed like I am now, I knew I was going out. Didn't know where I was going, but I was going out clean. If I had Joe's chili all over me, I knew I was coming in. And what I'd do is I'd ride out and I'd be confused. I wouldn't know where I was going, and I'd go check in a motel just to try to settle down, get my nerves under, and find out what I'm supposed to do. And I'd start making phone calls to my customers, and I'd say, and now in my job, I went to see my customers like at lunch, or I'd make an 11 o'clock appointment, and I'd call and I'd say, could I come over for lunch? They'd say, well, fool, you was over here yesterday. Or I'd call them and they'd say, where have you been? Where's my sample? I wouldn't know what kind of sample I'd send them. So life is just bad. And I came home sometime in September from Augusta, Georgia, and I think maybe I came home to die. I'd just given up. I got home and I went back in what Nancy referred to as my rat hole. And I stayed back in that rat hole, and I'm not sure how long I stayed back there. My wife was an only child. She had absolutely no relations anywhere. But you'd ask the neighbors, and she'd be gone to visit relatives. I don't know where she went, but she got away from me. And this is one of those times when she had been gone. Anyway, I've been back there several days, and I'm laying in that drunken lair where you just wake up and take a drink, go back, puke a little bit, take another drink, pass out. And I remember coming to, and my legs were so wobbly I couldn't walk to the bathroom. I had to crawl to the bathroom. And I hurt all over. And I took a drink or two and nothing happened. Liquor quit and I didn't know what to do. When liquor quit, I didn't know what to do. And it absolutely frightened me to death, because always I found myself in this same situation many times, but three or four big pulls of vodka would get me out of it. Nothing was working, and I remember just dropping my head on my hands and saying, my God, nobody knows. And she's standing there, and she said, yeah, AA might know. She got me dressed. We went to a meeting that night. I have no idea what went on at that meeting. There are a few people were around. I don't know whether there's anybody around now that was at that meeting and I went to. I do know this, that on the way home, she started fussing, chin music. You didn't pick up a chip. And I said, no, because if I don't get a drink down tonight, I'll die. Now, I think that's the first time I ever seriously thought about my drinking and the plight that I was in. Because I made that conscious decision. And that night I did get a drink or two down, you know, one down, two up, that kind of thing. But that's the last drink I took. And more than likely the last drink I've had was on the 23rd, but I'll wait 2 days. 2 days to celebrate my dry date. And to me, that's kind of a God thing, because I didn't have enough sense to do this. I realize today, you know, most people, and me too, as soon as we get sober, we want to get that chip. But for some reason, I waited 2 days, and I think that God knew me well enough to know that if I had a chip, that just might be a false date, that I'd lose faith in you all because you didn't know, and I'd lose faith in AA and I'd drink again. But for whatever reason it was, I waited for that 2 days, and I'm very thankful for that. Now, since that day in September of 73, life has made 180-degree turn in my life. If you would have told me that I was going to be in Madison, Virginia, talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and the miracles that God had worked in my life on a Saturday morning, I would have thought you were crazy. I did not realize that it was possible for a man to live the type of life that I have now. And I love the theme of this conference, a new freedom and a new happiness, because that's what I've found here. And if you're new, you think about this, a new freedom and a new happiness. I'll digress just a minute. There's a dessert back there. And the lady made it. I think she said she called it coconut dessert. But whatever it is, I went out after I had a couple of dishes of it. I went out in the car and read my big book. I thought it was somewhere it ought to be mentioned in there. That's how good it was. That was new happiness for the alcoholic. And I thought, you know, I don't remember a thing about the first 100 talking about that dessert. But anyway, that's just foolishness. Anyhow, I was told, I've been fortunate as most people, is I had good sponsorship, but I didn't get the sponsorship right away. I've had three phases of sobriety. The first phase was with no God. The second phase was as God. And the third phase is with God. And let me tell you, the phase with God is what works. Neither one of those other twos, without or as, neither one of them worked. And you know, thinking about this, I spent a time right when I got sober. It was almost like one of these old country boys in the tents getting religion. And I got into service work in big way. And I was trying to save everybody everywhere. And I would go around reading this. And I got it because it is very important. It was important to me then. And it's important now. And that's not it. Anyway, it's here somewhere. It doesn't matter. It talks about in the service manual, it talks about Alcoholics Anonymous being a fellowship of men and women who are in action. And unless we do this action, there's many men and women out there that are will die on the vine. And that's what I see here in this group. I see a group of men and women in action. I was talking to one of the guys making coffee this morning. And I thanked him for making that coffee. Because I'll tell you, I don't know your conference, but I know most of the ones I've been to. If Dave didn't show up and a lady speaker didn't show up and I didn't, wouldn't be a big deal. Somebody out there would tell their story. But if there's no coffee, you're going to raise the roof of this church. The most important person here is that coffee maker, and I told him so. Alcoholics Anonymous, the main thing I think, if I had to pick one main thing that they forced me into, and they didn't really suggest it, they forced me, the old bald-headed, white-headed men forced me to get a home group. And I've always been in that home group, and I love you gotta have a home group. If I sponsor you, you gotta have a home group, cause a home group saved my life. You go to a lot of meetings, I encourage a lot of meetings, go to 500 and 500 days, do whatever. But get your home group. One where on Tuesday night and Friday night you're gonna be there, come hell or high water. You're either sick or out of town or you're at that meeting. Sometimes a death certificate, we allow them, we'll sign off if they get their spouse to bring their death certificate. We'll accept that. And incidentally, I belong to the traditional group of Greenville, South Carolina, and we meet on Tuesdays and Fridays at 8:00. Open speaker meeting on Tuesdays, closed discussion meeting and book studies on Friday night. So I wanted to get that in. Sometimes I forget it, and that home group's very important to me. Now, the reason I depend so much on home groups, I was a kind of alcoholic. So I didn't do everything right when I first got here. And they had a deal where they wouldn't have a subject, and they'd say, has anybody got anything that's hurting their sobriety? Well, man, I have, you know, I took that opportunity. You don't want to give an alcoholic like me that change. And I'd throw a subject out there, and they'd jump on it and discuss it for the whole meeting. And I'm laughing to myself and being smug about how I controlled that meeting. None of that stuff I was talking about was true. It didn't make any difference. They'd just discuss it, and I felt real good. And that's the kind of guy I was. I was a slip planner. I don't know whether we got any slip planners here or not, but I used to sit on the front row. I remember one night I'm sitting on the front row, and I got the mug of beer. See, I was real intelligent. I'd never tasted light beer. And I got to thinking, that sounds simple enough. So I knew where they had some cold beer, and I'm sitting there on that front row this night, and the frost is just coming down over that mug. I'm not hearing a word the speaker says, and I know as soon as that meeting's over, I'm going to go and get that light beer. Well, when the meeting was over, they gave out the chip, and Sam, who had about the same number of months I got up to get a chip, and he looked like a Mack truck had hit him. I mean, both eyes were black. He looked bad. And I said, Sam, what in the world happened? He said, Wednesday, a week ago, I started drinking light beer. And I thought, scratch plan A, you know, get something else. Now, we had an old lady there that, as I'm throwing out all these fictitious things that are going on, she saw that what I was looking for was something you all didn't have covered. And that would make me different, and I could drink. And she was one of these old ladies, like she'd come up to me and she'd say, son, before you take a drink, call me at this number. I'd say, Taylor, you gave me that too. That's all right. You may have lost it. Take my phone number. Call me. So I had her number, and I've been out on the road traveling, and customers not buying anything. It'd been a bad week. And front office is mad at me, and I called home, and the chin music already started, and I just pulled off at the rest area on the interstate, got on the telephone and called Taylor, and I explained all this trauma going on in my life, and I explained that I'm 5 miles from home at the interstate, and I got 7 liquor stores to pass, and it's an impossibility for me to get by these liquor stores without stopping and getting something to drink. And I said, old woman, you told me to call you. What do you want me to do? And there was a pause on the other end of the line. She said, look, go out in the median between the strips of highway and strip off naked and stand there till they take you to jail. Now, you know, I thought, that dang old woman is crazy. She is crazy. And she'd insulted my intelligence. I wish I'd never even spent a dime to call her, you know. And I slammed that telephone down, and I was mad. I went right by every one of those liquor stores. And you know what? We know today that Taylor stole my slip. So there's always been somebody. There's been a Sam. There's been somebody to steal my slip. And I find out about these things. I find out about these things because I continue to go to meetings. For instance, I was in a meeting and I heard a lady from California. And I never know what I'm going to hear. I always hear something when I hear an AA speaker. I always hear something that I can put to work in my life to help me. And I heard this lady from California say that she was 9 months sober. And she went in, she just decided it wasn't worth it. And so she went to the liquor store and bought a half a pint of liquor and started out, and she had to write a check for the liquor. And she said, what is today? And they told her Friday the 12th. And she said, oh my goodness. She said, I can't get this liquor. I'm cookie lady at the home group. And she took the liquor down and put it up and went and took the cookies to the group. Now, she hadn't had a drink in 20 years. Now that made sense to me. She had a responsibility. She had a responsibility in her home group. She had something going on that she was supposed to do, that she'd committed to do, and had a sponsor that drilled commitment into her head. And it made sense right then. I have tried to make it possible, whether it's just greeter or something, to have some kind of a duty at my home group that I'm supposed to take care of. And I call it my cookie lady sobriety. And this was 15 or 20 years ago that I heard her speak, and that cookie lady sobriety has worked for me ever since. I have a commitment to take somebody to my meeting. Todd and I were just talking as we were driving up here. I've got a boy that I go by and pick up now. He's new, and I take him to the meeting. And I'd kind of let the thing slip because I hadn't gotten anybody to go by and get him. So I'm busy on the telephone calling to find another guy that I sponsor or somebody that I know in the home group to make sure that George gets to a meeting. And so just hearing that lady say that meant so much to me. The other thing that I think about is the gift of sobriety to me has just been fantastic. And I don't believe that you can get the gift that is as great as and as rewarding as this gift of sobriety has been to me without there being a lot of responsibility involved. I feel like I'm responsible to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when a sick newcomer like I comes in and get him by the hand, make him welcome. You know, our book says the substitute for alcohol is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. That fellowship starts when somebody shakes your hand. And after he's been accumulated a little bit, he may want you to take him by the hand and walk him through the steps. But there's a responsibility with it, and I don't think I can fulfill that responsibility if I'm at a baseball game or a football game when I'm supposed to be at home group. I also believe that just maybe, God gave me this gift of sobriety. God gave me the power and showed me how to get out from under the awful things that were happening in my life in the disease of alcoholism, to carry that message to one man. And I have no idea where that man is or where that man's going to show up. So if I'm on the hotline at home and I got the popcorn popped and the Super Bowl's fixing to come on and the telephone rings and old Joe down at the motel needs somebody to come talk to him, I better go. I'd hate to be sitting there eating that popcorn, watching the Super Bowl, when the one man God wanted me to carry the message to was down there at the motel waiting on me. And so it's an absolute necessity with me that I have the ability to go and do what I've the best of my ability at what I can do. And I have, you know, I'm suffering with a guy that I sponsored. He's been a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he's had some trouble. His father died. Now, this is his story. His father died, and he felt like he needed a little something to get through the grieving period. So the doctor prescribed Xanax. So he took a Xanax, and he got through one day, I guess. And I'm just, you know, and the next day, and the next day, and another little something happened, another Xanax, and another little something, another. And pretty soon, the Xanax are going in, and he doesn't know where he's coming or going or whatever. And I look back on life, and that's kind of how I've done Alcoholics Anonymous. I have trauma in my life, and I'll explain some of that to you in a minute. But I have a lot of trauma in my life. And I ask God for help. And I use God's help, and I get through that particular traumatic situation, and my faith increases. So the next time trauma comes up, I take two more situations, and slowly my faith builds up. And instead of putting in a Zantac, I put in faith. I get in touch with the higher power. And I think that's what we're taught here. It certainly worked for me. I tell you, I had trauma. I'd been married I'd been sober about 9 years. I'd been sober about 9 years, and my wife, my Al-Anon of 9 years, passed away very suddenly. And you know, I didn't know how to handle. I didn't know how to handle death. I'm the kind of alcoholic that when death came along, the only thing I knew to do was get drunk. I was drunk with my daddy. at my daddy's funeral, drunk at my mother's funeral. I didn't know how to handle it. And so, but the old timers had never said anything to me about this, but I had noticed going to many meetings that I'd see an old timer and he wouldn't be exactly at his home group. He was at another meeting and another meeting that he usually didn't go to. And I'd go up and I'd say something to him, and inevitably something very traumatic had happened in his life, something serious to it. And he was tripling up and doubling up on his Alcoholics Anonymous commitments. So they had shown me through their actions what I needed to do. And that's what I did. I tripled up on all my AA involvement after Nancy passed away. Now, God helped me here because I began to get more newcomers came into my life to help me with this. I got people asking me to do more things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I wasn't volunteering for. They were just coming to me with them. And I realized today, that's God's work. That's God's work. But after it had been about a year and a half or 2 years after Nancy passed away and going to AA on a regular basis three and four different times, I became very lonely. And all of you in AA, you know that if you're going to tripling up on your AA meetings, you're going to triple up on seeing the ladies too. So I met this real wonderful lady named Donna, and we were married almost 19 years, and we had a great AA relationship. She was a powerful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, had a much better program than I had. She sponsored a lot of people, and she lived by the book 100%. And we got along real well in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we spoke a lot together at different conferences, and I was up in the mountains of Virginia, in fact down at Draper's Valley. Some of you may know where that is. There's a golf course there, and about 100 of us out of four states get together there every Memorial Day and have a big AA golf outing. And I was at that golf outing, and I got a call, and Donna had an aneurysm and fallen dead in the floor in the kitchen, and some of them had found her, and they brought me back from the golf outing. And I can remember riding down the mountain from the golf outing, and I wasn't mad at God. I wasn't upset with God. And this kind of, I didn't know what kind of, exactly what kind of a mood I should be in. But I know that my prayer was, God, what do you want me to learn from this? Show me what I'm supposed to learn. How can I use this to help other people and get me through this? And I never have been as grateful that not only was I a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was married to a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because at the wake, when people are coming and I'm standing there and I see the line, and most of them are all AAers, and they're not just people coming up with condolences and say, they're alive, they're human, they're mother and father that's gotten their children back. Their children have been reunited with their parents. It was just full of stories coming up, and it was powerful to me, just powerful. And I was so grateful that I was allowed to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in that kind of situation. And so the power, I have found that the power is here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and above all, I'm taught how to get in touch with that power. And that's why the 11th step is so important to me. I call the 11th step my walking around step. That's one. I call it my American Express step. I wouldn't want to leave home without it. That 11th step tells me what to pray for. It tells me as soon as I know what God's will is, that most of the time I'm not going to want to do it, so I have to keep praying. I have to keep praying till I get the power to carry God's will out. So it not only tells me how to live my life, it tells me when things aren't going the way I know God wants them to go, and I'm not doing what God thinks that I think God wants me to do. It gives me that little deal, I call it the pause that refreshes. It talks about pausing. And I just pause, and it gives me a chance to take a look at my life. What am I doing? What am I doing wrong? What have I not done right? And inevitably, I find out what I need to do. I need to add a little something on. A lot of times it's to leave a little something off, whatever. But when I take that pause and I get in touch with my higher power, I know what to do. Now, I told you, I triple up on Alcoholics Anonymous, so after Donna died, I'm tripling up, and I got kind of lonely, and I met Judy. And Judy now, and I've been married, we've been married 9 years. And she's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So God's been good to this old alcoholic. I had 9 years with an Al-Anon, and they were great. I had 19 years with an AA, and they were great. I've got 9 years now with an alcoholic, and they're great. And I think it's because we put God and Alcoholics Anonymous before anything else in our lives. In all of these marriages, we always read together, meditated together in the morning, invited God into our marriage to guide and direct what we do on a daily basis. And it's amazing. It's worked real well. All three of my wives have been absolutely as different as day and night. And because God's in charge of these things, we've gotten along just as well as it's possible to do. So I'm convinced that the power is here, and all I have to do is to call on Him and ask Him. Now, I told you I had that one son, and he was quite a football player, and he had two children. And those grandchildren, one of them's 35, one of them's 36, they've never seen me take a drink. If I never get another reward out of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's enough reward. And I used to say that. For instance, my grandson, doesn't have a problem with alcohol, but he grew up around alcoholics, and he likes his granddaddy, and he shows up. He'll call and say, "Can I play golf with you all?" And he comes and plays golf with the AAers. He likes AA so much. He's at every one of my AA celebrations. My son's not in Alcoholics Anonymous. Doesn't need to be. He's a wannabe. He would love to be. And he, you know, but he can't. He's not tough enough. He's just not tough enough. I mean, he'll get a little bit too much on a football, and he'll be sick for 3 weeks. His head'll hurt, and he won't touch it. But he loves Alcoholics Anonymous, and he sends some of his friends. You know, if they get in trouble, they know where to go. And it's crazy. They go to him. They kind of use him to come to me, you know. So Alcoholics Anonymous has been very influential in my life. And I think about this thing. When I said that you couldn't ask for any better rewards than two grandchildren that never seen me drink, well, my story's changed in the last 18 months. I've got three great-grandchildren. Two little girls and a little boy. They've never seen me drink. And I hope that if I keep listening to you people, that they never have to see me. So Alcoholics Anonymous, that's proof. It's a gift that just keeps on giving. Incidentally, my granddaughter's a school teacher. And she came up and asked me if I'd come over to her school and speak to her children about alcoholism. And this made me feel good. She's the little girl that said, "Oh, Papa, I don't believe you've ever been in jail. Not you, you know." So she didn't know. But anyway, I was real preppy, and I went over, and I'm standing out in the lobby, and I'm waiting on Allison to come out. And this little old gray-headed principal came up, and she looked me right in the eye. She said, "Are you Allison's granddaddy?" Well, I never know who I guess I'll never find out who I am, you know. But thank God, this afternoon I know who I am. I'm an alcoholic that found a substitute for alcohol right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thank you for letting me tell you about it. Thank you.